Yo, what's cracking? This your homeboy Ice Cube, and you tuned in to Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. You know what it is, baby.
Hey, everybody. This is Mike with the Mountain Weekly News. Welcome back to episode number 51 of the Everything Snowboarding, Outdoors, and More podcast. This week's podcast is being sponsored by OK E-Bikes. OKAI. OK E-Bikes is probably the first company to manufacture a true smart e-bike. We just posted the review up of the EB50 e-bike. You're going to love this thing. It is gnarly. Touchscreen computer. You can control everything from your app. It's got onboard running lights that you can change on the side of different colors. All sorts of cool stuff. So anyway, check out this e-bike from OK E-Bike, the OK EB50. This week's special guest is Shepard Humphreys and Scott Austin. These guys are part of the group that just put a new world record together. They took the longest long-range precision shot ever taken. The shot was 4.4 miles, and they ended up hitting the target. So I'm going to let these guys talk all about it. Really, really fun interview. And if you like hunting, if you like shooting, even if you're not into any of that kind of stuff, take a listen to this interview, because they kind of, I mean, we just talk about the ethics of all of it, and it's just a really fun one. So enjoy this interview. First of all, congratulations, gentlemen. Shepard Humphreys and Scott Austin. We have a new world record for the extreme long-range shot, 4.4 miles. This happened here in Wyoming on September 13th. And gentlemen, if you could just give us a little background about kind of your backgrounds and how you came to have this idea, and then how this came to fruition to go and tackle the world's longest range, long-range shot.
Well, I'll start. I grew up in the back hills of Tennessee. This is Shepard. And I was interested in shooting, you know, just kind of casually. I would plink at walnuts on trees and squirrels and such. And that was kind of the beginning. And then years later, I wound up having the idea to start the Jackson Hole Shooting Experience. And I started that business. And through running an entertainment shooting business, I became more and more interested in shooting, and competed in pistol matches for a while. And then my interest switched to long range shooting. And, then it kind of grew from there. I've done a little bit of competing, but I'm not really all that good. So I was always in the bottom half of, you know, any group I would compete with. I just enjoy doing it and having fun. That's what it's about for me.
Yeah. Similar to Shep. I started out pretty young shooting, and my grandfather owned a farm in southern Illinois, and it was just a matter of, that was the Wild West for me, and he introduced me to shooting. And I had a cousin, or my father's cousin, excuse me, ended up coming back from the military, and he got way into firearms during that time, but he ended up taking a dime, walking out to 100 yards, putting it in a crack in a log, and proceeded to shoot it. And I was hooked at that point. And I think it was about 10 years ago that Shep said, "Hey, can you give me a hand on a couple that I'm instructing right now? They've got to get to the airport quick and running out of time. Could you work with a gentleman, and I'll work with his wife and do some instruction?" And from that point on, he gave me a call back, I think about 2 weeks later, and said, "Hey, would you be interested in instructing for us?" And since that time, I've gone through a number of genres of firearm sports, you know, pistol, rifle, shotgun, and then landed on the long range shooting, and that has not subsided, because I think once you get comfortable shooting at a certain distance, to push yourself again, just simply move the target, and I've been hooked ever since.
And so you guys, I mean, I've been lucky enough to take classes with both Shepard and Scott, as far as training with rifles and shooting. And the first time was with Shepard, and I remember I got to go to the Jackson Hole Shooting Experience and shoot some of the long-range rifles. And I'll never forget that, you know, with the rifle on the stand and going through all the training, at the end of the class, I ended up hitting a target out to 600 yards, and I was just floored by that. And I got a, you know, I have a little casing at home on a keychain that I got, And then fast forward to a week ago, I went and took a class with Scott, kind of to tune up my hunting rifle, just to make sure everything was good. I had taken the scope off and I had had to send it back to Ruger. So there was a lot of stuff that was going on with it. And so I just wanted to just really make sure my confidence was up. And I had ended up actually scoping myself last year, kind of long story. So I wanted to really go with the pros. And with Scott, I kind of went there thinking I was going to shoot, you know, 100 to 200 yards. That's kind of the range that I've typically gotten my animals in. And Scott actually started me at 250 yards and then 300. And then we went to 400 and 500 and 600. And that progression, I felt so confident having the pros do this. So then Scott had mentioned that you guys were going after this new record. And I kind of chuckled and I thought, well, I can't think of any better people to do it, because you guys truly, you're not just out there shooting. I mean, you're instructing, you're living, breathing. You've got the Jackson Hole shooting experience, which is incredible. Anybody that's ever in this community should definitely, even if you don't think you're a firearms person or if you've never had experience, it's a great place to start. And then for seasoned pros, I think anybody can get something out of that. And then you guys also have a side business, the Nomad Rifleman. Is that kind of where this world record thing went through, or was this also with the shooting experience?
You know, it's funny. We started Nomad Rifleman, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, something like that, just to have a more distant ranges than the 600 yards that our awesome home range that we use allows or has targets at. And so we started up the business. And then as years went by, we've had a number of clients. Almost everything we do is on a private level. And the clients come out and they shoot with us. And then we end up becoming friends. And one of them, each time we go to New Mexico, we go and stay with them at their house. And now we go out shooting and there's no money exchange. So I guess we should quit making friends with people, because it's going to take us to the poorhouse. But we've just kind of over the years gotten to know more and more shooters who are interested in long range, and it's a really small community. And so that kind of our niche is taking people out and helping them get their first 1 mile hits or mile and a quarter, and sparking that interest. Some people just do it for fun as a one-time thing, and then they'll never shoot again. They're just, you know, it's a fun activity while they're on vacation, or they'll fly to Jackson to do it. But that's kind of how we came about starting Nomad Rifleman. And then this world record shot wasn't even a part of that. It was just, we kind of did this as a separate group of friends going out and having fun. And some of Scott's relatives were out helping us, and just friends, and some of the coaches who we do shoot with at the shooting experience that we got shooting with it for fun. Also, they were out there helping us. My wife was out there. And so, yeah, we just kind of had a fun day as friends out, seeing what we could do and pushing the limits.
You mentioned custom rifle or custom ammunition. I mean, somebody's not going to go to the store and buy a rifle or a box of ammunition off the shelf and be able to go out and shoot to these distances. Is that correct?
Absolutely. This is so finely tuned. I mean, just to give you an idea, there was the first part of this equation is purchasing a bullet that we believe will make the transition going from supersonic velocity to subsonic and being stable after it goes through that transition. So everything gets built around a specific bullet. Then they chamber it with a specific length, with a specific charge. And just to give you an idea of why we do that, you know, when you're shooting tight groups at 100 yards, you can have a variation in velocity anywhere from 40 to 60 feet per second and still shoot a one hole group. You won't be able to do that at these kind of distances. In fact, if you look at the data on this, every foot per second variation in your velocity would equal 32 inches of vertical spread at 4.4 miles. So the whole goal in going from the bullet or working from the bullet out is to get low standard deviations from shot to shot. Otherwise, you're just all over the map and you're just lobbing them in there. And I know there's been some naysayers going, yeah, you guys are just mortaring them in. But if you truly understand what it takes to get a bullet anywhere near that target, you'd say, wow, that's quite the goal.
And you had a team of spotters. You guys had built a custom, I think Shep was involved in welding and building a steel shed that, you know, because you're not going to be able to see the impact typically from the distance you're at. And so now all of a sudden you guys are using sound to try and find where this bullet is going so that you can help give guidance, you know, different adjustments. And it took 69, you got it on the 69th, Winston got it on the 69th shot. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And we actually had five of these bunkers. And my wife, Lynn, also an extreme long-range shooter, she was the one who, kind of when we discovered some months ago in testing, hey, we can only see less than 5% or 10% visual impacts. We can't see the dust signatures at over 4 miles from these bullets. They're coming in at such a steep angle, and they're, you know, it's a long, skinny bullet and just pierces right into the ground, and we can't see anything. And so then we kind of thought, well, the way to do this would be audible spotting. But then you think about if you were standing out in the lawn, Mike, and I tossed, you closed your eyes, and I tossed a pebble, and you heard it land, you could roughly say, yeah, it's somewhere off to the right, 5 or 10 feet away, but you wouldn't be able to pinpoint it like you would if I threw it into a dusty area and you actually saw a plume of dust come up. So we were dealing with this difficult audio spotting thing. And so my wife designed the spotting layout, and she wanted one bunker 20 yards short of the target, one bunker 20 yards beyond the target, a bunker that was 20 yards left and 10 yards short, another one 20 yards right and 10 yards short, and then one that was, I think, at 60 or 70 yards short. And the two that were short were directly under the bullet's flight path. And the reason for that was so that those folks, you can kind of hear a whistle before the thud. And so the spotters needed to know if it was to the right or left of the target. And as a spotter, and I did a bunch of spotting during our testing, it was really fun. You would hear Scott would take a shot, and then he would, I think, stand up or roll away from the gun, get on the two-way radio and say, shots away. And I would start counting 1,001, 1,002, 1,003. And at about 12 seconds, I would hear a distant bang. And then I would count another 12 seconds. And depending on how high the bullet was above my head, I would hear either a whistling sound or nothing. And then I would hear a thud, a thump, as the bullet went into the ground. And as we continued testing, the groups were nice and tight. The last 7 of 8 tests, they were all within a 50-yard area of the target. And then we just kept trying to figure out how to hone them in more.
Wait, so when Winston pulled the trigger, you're saying it was up to almost 24 seconds until impact?
That is correct.
24.5. Yep.
Wow. I mean, this is...
And therein lies some of the variability in a shot like this, because we don't have technology at this point to predict or control what's happening in the atmosphere 2,500 feet above our heads, because that's where the bullet's flying.
Wow. Wow. And so obviously things like weather came into play. You had to have a safe location, you know, a location where there was no chance of anybody walking in. Obviously, you guys are really mindful of wildlife. You know, when we were out at the shooting range, yep, Scott had mentioned, you know, hey, there is a chance that, you know, especially during hunting season, you know, the animals know that this is a safe area. And so if a deer walks out, like, that's not happening. And it was really nice, because what you guys are doing here, I mean, this is, you know, for somebody that doesn't hunt, that's listening to this podcast, you know, these aren't the ranges that people hunt by any means. You know, typically, nope, like I said, for myself, 100 to 300 yards, Scott did get me up to about 600. I think now I would comfortably take a shot to 400 if I really needed to, possibly 500. What is, you know, a typical, like, if somebody's going out to the range, what kind of long range do they like to do? I mean, is it trying to go to 600 is kind of the standard right now for people that are, you know, just have, you know, maybe a hunting rifle or a long range rifle that want to go out and do some target shooting?
Well, I'll give a brief response, and then
go ahead.
Scott is a hunter, so he'll chat a bit more about this, but I'm not a hunter. I'm not a big game hunter. But when I go to long-range shooting competitions and I'm competing against people who are much better than I am, and they're hitting first-round hits at 1,200 yards on not too big a targets, and I hear all these guys chatting, and they say they would never take a shot beyond 300, maybe 400 yards. And these are some of the best shooters. They say it's just not ethical. You don't know what the animal's going to be doing. So that's kind of my thought. Scott has mentioned a good point to me that if a person is really good at shooting 1,000 yards, then you still go out and hunt at 200 or 300 yards. But if you make that bad shot at some point and the animal is limping and you need to get it and it's now moved out to 400 or 500 or 600 yards, it's nice to know that you have a better chance of ending their misery. Right. Is that roughly what you have shared with me, Scott?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if Mike, as you spend more time out hunting, it's not if, but when, you're not going to have that perfect shot. And we have great respect for the animals that we're pursuing. And at that point, when you make that shot that's not perfect, it's your responsibility to get it, suffering over and done with as quick as possible. So that's one of the things that I really enjoy in terms of training people is, they'll say, well, I'm never going to take a shot like this. Well, I'm like, well, thank you. And I greatly appreciate that. But when you take that shot at 300, 400 yards and that animal goes off wounded, and now he's standing at 600 yards ready to go over the ridge, and this is not going to be good for this animal. You now have the ability to make that happen, to stop that animal suffering. And I think the biggest issue for me, although I can appreciate some of these guys' ability to shoot is absolutely phenomenal, far better than mine, maybe not Shep. Shep undersells himself. He is a phenomenal shot. He's just very humble about it. But the issue is what's called time of flight. When you press that trigger, there is a time lag from when that bullet leaves your barrel and ends up hitting that animal. And once you get past, I would say for me, myself, and I, 500 yards would be the absolute max that I would ever take a shot. And every aspect of that shot would have to be perfect. Zero wind, I'm laying prone over something that is absolutely rock solid. And I know my gun and I know my dope, which is data observed on previous engagement. That means I've plotted that bullet to those distances. That is the very max that I will shoot at an animal. Because that time lag, anything past that, and that animal has the ability to take a step, to bend down, to feed, to do whatever, and you can't control that within a longer time lag. So we really, really, really encourage people, do your due diligence. Hunting isn't just about the shot. It's about the experience. It's about the pursuit. Getting close to the animals, you'll find it's far more exciting than taking a long shot. I mean, I get all my kicks and giggles and adrenaline rush shooting at stuff at a mile or 1,000 yards or 600 yards, something like that. Don't go get your kicks on animals. That's, it's great when you make a great shot, but they're not to practice on in that sense would be my thoughts.
For sure. And you guys do it really, I love how you're explaining this and how you're teaching it and the ethics of all of this. What about, in the armed forces, like what kind of range would snipers, somebody, in the U.S. military, what are they practicing at?
Well, I'm a big peace pick, so I'm not going to support or condone any of that nonsense, but it kind of depends on the situation. It kind of comes down to probability, and probability is when you take some shots, like if you went out right now with your rifle, and you had a nice solid shooting platform, how many shots out of 10 could you put inside of a 10-inch circle at 100 yards? And I would say that your correct answer would be a 10. You could do 10 out of 10. If we now move that out to a 10-inch circle at 500 yards, you might get one or two or three or four, but probably not five. And then as we go out further and further, our hit probability, Scott and I argue about this, but our hit probability at 4.4 miles with no wind, I think it's somewhere around one out of 50, one out of 100 shots. And Scott is way more optimistic and confident than I am, but that's what I think our hit probability would be. So in a government's military situation, they would be thinking about, well, what is this shot? If they have been called out to rescue a captain on a bobbing boat and they have to hit a 1-inch area shooting right past the head of the person they're trying to save, then it's going to be a very different distance than if they are thinking of other human beings as ground squirrels and they don't really care if they hit or not. It's just fun to take pot shots because they're the bad guys. So it kind of depends on what the scenario is for the shooter.
Yeah. And I, you know, Shep and I are in different places in terms of, you know, philosophically, spiritually, those types of things. You know, I believe that there are bad people that do bad things. And I think I remember listening to a lady one time who was the head of a museum, a Holocaust museum, and somebody asked her, you know, do you think Hitler was crazy? And she said just flat out, no, I think he was just evil. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. So I know there's bad guys out there, and I can personally say I'm glad when those bad guys need to go away. But in terms of the distance that they're shooting, you know, they're trained to the nth degree by phenomenal instructors. And I know one of those instructors personally, and he's not a military guy. He's a slow-talking, slow-walking old farm boy that learned to shoot really, really well and sees the need to, okay, these people are a threat to other people or maybe our nation, and I'm going to train these guys to do that. So they're trained in the fundamentals to shoot at various distances. And then after that, it becomes tactics of how you go about getting shots at long, long distances there. And, you know, in military and law enforcement, I think law enforcement, Shep would know this, the average precision shot typically in those circles is either 63 or 68 yards. With respect to military, it's much, much further, and they're given a lot more latitude.
Awesome. And how long until, I mean, you guys are active in this, in the long-range community. I mean, is there buzz right now? I mean, is there... It has, you know, Winston's number. Is this like somebody like, okay, well, I want to go and try and go 4.5 miles? Or, I mean, do you see anybody trying to do this? Because this wasn't something that just came about today or yesterday. I mean, this was you guys spent a couple of years planning this.
Yeah.
And then all of your background and, you know, decades of experience in what you do. Do you see anybody ever wanting to try and replicate this? I mean, obviously conditions, the location, I mean, there's a lot, the gun, the ammunition, the spotters, the team, the audible. I mean, is this something that people will try and challenge?
You know, there's a couple of guys out. Yeah. A couple of guys out there. Paul Phillips, who held the last world record, that our friend beat. And then, of course, Brian Litz, who's probably one of the world's foremost ballisticians, ballistics expert. And they've inspired us to the nth degree. I mean, these are the giants that, you know, we're standing on their shoulders. They're the ones who have laid the foundation. They're the ones who have been going and doing cutting-edge things to make this possible. You know, looking at their gear, looking at the science behind what they're doing, has, like I said, really inspired us. I think it was Paul Phillips who said, you know, we hope other people beat our record. And I think we're in the same place because we realize that this extended, I don't even know that I would call it extended long range. I would maybe say extended long range. I mean, it's way out of the wheelhouse of what most people would even consider trying. That genre of shooting is literally still in its infancy. You know, the ability to predict wind 24 seconds ahead of your bullet entering that atmosphere isn't there. Although today I'm meeting with a gentleman who developed the wind particle reader. And that technology is coming to fruition. But even that is in its infancy, and how it can tell you what's happening right now in the atmosphere, but it can't tell you or predict what's happening in the future. Almost like, you know, reading a radar screen, and you can predict, okay, this is the direction that those winds are flowing. You would have to develop some type of algorithm you'd have to test time and time again to try to get this thing right. So yeah, there's guys out there that are doing this and you know, wanting to beat our record and wanting to go even further.
Yeah, and when it will happen, I don't know. You know, it could happen next week. Somebody might have had this in the works and be almost ready to go out and take their shot. Most of the things that we did, almost everything, Scott and I kind of have the attitude that, you know what, let's just help the next person, because we were searching for information. You know, how do we go about doing this? And when you're going beyond what anyone's ever done before, you can't just go read the manual on it, because no one's ever done it. And you kind of have to say, well, who was close? And so thank goodness for Paul Phillips paving the path. His team were able to look and go, okay, well, maybe this is a good caliber. And well, it was a different one than Hill Country used when they set the record some years ago, a shorter record. And as each person goes beyond, there's a certain amount of proprietary, you know, before we took the shot, there's no way I would have told you what distance we were going. I tried to put the misinformation out that we were going a little over 4.2 miles because one of our competitors was getting ready to make a shot. Then they would think, oh, well, I'll just get prepared for 3.3. So there's a little bit of gaming going on in that sense. However, we had Scott went over to Idaho with a master engineer, terminal ballistics expert, and did testing on steel to determine what kind of bunkers we should have. And we're publishing the report on that. Like, we want everybody to be safe. We want our record to be beaten in a week or a year or 10 years or whenever. I suspect that 5 miles will happen within 5 years, perhaps much sooner, but I think someone will get 5 miles almost certainly within 5 years.
No, I was just going to say, we've got a few things behind the scenes with respect to technology and design on certain components that we believe could potentially be game changers in this. And so we're working with the people on that to hopefully make some more aha moments. So stay tuned on that. Shep's like, no, no. Because this was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get here.
Definitely. And I think that the community, you know, is really going to love the information, you know, about the bunkers, because when I first saw the press release and kind of saw the video, I think I had read or saw that Lynn Shepherd's wife was actually in one of the bunkers near the target. And so I'm thinking, gosh, you put your wife out there in like the bunker, like this, I mean, and how would you even test the steel to know, like, oh yeah, like at this distance, this is how far. And so when I got to come and shoot with you, Scott, I was, the first hour of our instruction was, I didn't even shoot the gun. I mean, it was, we were going over ballistics and windage. And yep. I mean, it was so much technical information. I was blown away. I was like, whoa, I had no idea that all of this was involved. And so I'm sure that same thought process went into, you know, the safety and keeping everybody safe. I mean, this is just incredible. How about the guys who made the gun for you? Are you able to talk about the manufacturer or who was able to custom build the gun and the ammunition?
Absolutely. I would love to. So this gentleman, his name is Scott Knoll. He has two sons, Meshach and Nehemiah, and they are S&S Gunsmithing out of Driggs, Idaho. We are blessed to have a guy that is local, that is so close to us. This guy isn't just a machinist, I would say. In many ways, he's an artist. He is a been there, done that kind of a guy that has done a lot of long-range shooting in his own right that is, to my knowledge, never been published, but he shot distances far beyond, you know, most guys in the ELR world, and I think he did a lot of his shooting down in the Salt Flats in Salt Lake. But he's one of those guys that you meet with, and you have this idea in your head of where you want to go with a design, and by the time you're done meeting with him, you are so far ahead of what you thought was even possible. I mean, even if you're looking at just going and getting your hunting rifle worked on, this guy is the guy I would recommend. I've recommended many, many people to him. Initially, we were going to go with another gunsmith who's very well known in the ELR world for building amazing rifles. A lot of the records that have been, you know, set have been set with his rifles. And unfortunately, we weren't able to make that connection, and we're kind of scratching our head and looking at what Scott had been doing just for some of our rifles shooting at the range, and I'm like, I think this guy has the ability to do that. And he definitely made it happen. So kudos to Scott.
And last but not least,
Scott, would you talk about some of the rifle components that some of the various, how you picked the different parts?
Yeah, absolutely. So interestingly, about 5-6 years ago, I was at SHOT Show, which is the world's largest meeting of like-minded individuals that sell anything to do with firearms. And we're privileged to be in the 1,000 people out of 70,000 people at that who get invited to Range Day. In fact, I just got that in my email 2 days ago. We got invited again, which we're like, wow, we feel like small fish out there, and to get that invite is pretty awesome. So you get to test the components that are cutting edge. And I met this guy named Jacob Decker, and this is Ken Decker's son who runs TACCOM out of Arkansas. And they came up with this barrel. It's called a structured barrel or a dead barrel. And the whole idea behind this large, massive barrel is that instead of having a barrel width that causes your bullets to be inconsistent in their velocities, it has very little, so almost no width at all. So it's unbelievably consistent. So if you can kind of picture looking at the barrel end, a barrel in the middle with six barrels around it, those barrel channels are designed to cool your barrel as you shoot. So as your bullet heats up the bore, there's holes that towards the action on the rear end of the gun that suck air into them to cool the barrel. Kind of like your wood stove with the Venturi effect, you know, is when you get that fire going raging hot, that's when it's really sucking the air through the front of it. And that's the same thing that this barrel does. And I don't think we ended up over 91 degrees on the barrel itself. The muzzle brake had a little bit higher temperature at 110, but 91 degrees, this thing isn't heating up. Well, the reason we don't want it to heat up is because metal expands. It expands externally on your barrel and internally, therefore creating more pressure in your barrel. And as we talked about earlier, every foot per second increase or decrease, your variances go up by 32 inches on your target out there. So he made this barrel that was unbelievably consistent. The chassis or the stock came out of Canada. The muzzle brake came out of New Zealand. The optics for this are from Vortex, which is that Wisconsin or Minnesota, Shep?
I think so.
Somewhere Wisconsin. Up in the North Central. And then the guys that developed the barrel, TACCOM HQ, also developed two devices which were critical for us making a shot like this. The Charlie Tarak and the Delta Tarak, and these are two prism devices. One of them allows us to get up to what's called 900 minutes of elevation to be able to hold this high. Remember, we're holding almost 7,000 feet line of sight over the target. The bullet will eventually make it to just over 2,500 feet. It doesn't get to that line of sight, of course, because gravity's taken effect. But there's no way any scope has the adjustability for those kinds of elevation gains. So this Charlie Tarak gives us that ability. And then because the scope is angled so steeply to make this long, long shot, it's looking directly into the barrel. So you can't see around a barrel unless you put a prism on it. Kind of like a periscope looking around the edge of the barrel, and that's what the Delta Tarak does. So pretty sophisticated equipment that is very, very specific to this task.
Wow. And what kind of cost is involved, with a rifle like that?
It's a lot. it's a whole lot. The rifle, I think... If we were going to sell it now, we would probably, we're not going to sell it. If we were going to sell it, we would probably start entertaining bids around $40,000-ish. And we spent less getting it put together because, you know, people weren't giving us things for free. But we got some good deals along the way because yep. People supported our mission. But to replicate it, I would say... $40,000 should get the rifle, and then the optics are another. Well, the optics are another issue, but yeah, it was expensive.
Well, let's get some people to come out to the Jackson Hole shooting experience and see what yourself and Lynn and Scott and everybody's doing, because it's incredible. Again, I didn't grow up around guns. I didn't grow up a hunter. I didn't have family that had guns. I mean, so I moved out here and this was all completely new to me. And now I'm starting to identify as a hunter, and I'm starting to, you know, really enjoy going out there and having, knowing that there's a place. I mean, I will take a class once a year now moving forward. I think it's the best thing to do. And it's also something fun for people that maybe are on vacation here in the Tetons. It's like, well, what are you going to do today? It's like, okay, well, you can go ski, you can go to the park. Like, you can do all these traditional things, you know, whitewater rafting, but like the shooting experience. And I know back in the day, Shep, when we were kind of working together, I think Facebook at that time, you know, didn't really understand what you were doing. And so it was kind of almost hard to kind of promote, you know, shooting. I mean, it's safe, it's fun. What you guys are doing is something I think everybody should come experience. How can they find out more information to come and book either a private course or, you know, do one of your, you know, you've got so many different things available. Where do they find more information?
Well, our extreme long range shooting website is nomadrifleman.com. Our Jackson Hole based where we are, multi-gun experiences are our most popular one. That is shootinjh.com. But I would suggest that before a person decides if we're even right for them, check out TripAdvisor. Look up the Jackson Hole shooting experience on TripAdvisor. And that way we're not getting my slick salesman pitch. You're kind of getting what other people have experienced who have been out and done it, and see what they think of it.
Well, and you guys were some of the first guys that I called and reached out to. You know, 3 days after taking the rifle course with Scott, I ended up getting a mule deer buck here in the Tetons. And so it was, again, it felt really good. The confidence was there. I haven't gone on TripAdvisor yet and left a review about you guys, but I certainly will. And I know that people listening to this podcast are going to kind of love hearing about it, because, again, there is people in, you know, that are not, maybe people that aren't around guns as much that probably have a big stigma about guns and firearms in general. And it's, you guys have really helped me kind of get over that and the confidence. And I think that there's a reason that your team and your friends and your little select group was part of this group that was able to set this world record. So are you calling it the world record extended long range shot? Is that the definition?
You know, we haven't even really talked about a good name for it. I don't know. Just, well, let's call it a fun day. That's good enough. Or world record extreme. I don't know. Whatever. It was just kind of fun to see it happen.
Well, thank you guys again. I really appreciate having you on the podcast. This was just really fun. I mean, the whole time I'm just sitting here geeking out like, oh man, these guys are cool and shooting guns. And so thank you again for everything you're doing and for all the instruction that you've provided. And then, you know, and that gets passed down, you know, gun safety. And thank you for everything. And definitely check out Nomad Rifleman, check out the Jackson Hole shooting experience. And like Shep said, TripAdvisor probably has lots of really fun reviews on there. So definitely worth checking out here in the Tetons. And congratulations, gentlemen.
Thank you for the opportunity. Privilege. Fun chatting with you.
All righty. Well, you guys have a great day, and I look forward to coming out and shooting with you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye. All right, well, that was an incredibly fun conversation. You know, those guys, Scott has helped me, Shepard has helped me, and ended up getting a mule deer buck a couple days ago, and I was out there, I had that confidence that I knew Scott had shown me. You know, I was walking through the woods, I didn't have time to get to my knee or to get to a rest or to pull a shooting stick out. I just had time to lift my gun up and the deer was right in front of me, so got very lucky, and a lot of that, again, was that confidence that I had from the training I received from those guys. So really a wonderful episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. Episode number 51 of the Everything Snowboarding, Outdoors, and More podcast. And once again, this week's podcast is being sponsored by OK E-Bikes. Check these things out, the OK EB50. You're going to love it. I think I got it up to about 28 miles an hour. A little bit on the heavier side, big fat tire bike. But man, for cruising around town or for the winter time, this thing is going to be really fun to ride. So OK E-Bikes, thanks for sponsoring this episode.